All right, well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation and thanks for coming to the talk. So this is a PhD project of Guillaume Dauphiné, who is just about to finish his thesis. I'll start with a little bit of background and motivation for what we are doing. The motivation is topological quantum computation. This is computation which happens on a two-dimensional system. So you should think that you have a Hamiltonian on maybe nearest neighbor interaction on a lattice, and the ground state is degenerate, and it's separated from the other energy eigenstate by some constant spectral gap delta. The degeneracy of the ground state can be influenced by things like the manifold topology. So whether you put it on a plane or a donut, it will have a different amount of degeneracy. Or maybe you just have pinned excitation. And the way to think about pinned excitation, I mean, excitation and the ground state don't fit together. But if you modify the Hamiltonian so that, let's say, you relax the Hamiltonian constraint at some location, so you accept having excitations at these locations, so you're still in the ground state. This is also a way of increasing the degeneracy. Okay. And excitation in this model carry topological charges that I will label by letters like A, B, C. So how are these topological charges defined? Well, they're essentially defined by conservation. Okay, so if you take a region of space, and you look at the set of all configuration that you can reach on that region by applying some circuit on that region, all these configuration have, by definition, the same topological charge, provided that the region is topologically trivial. Okay, so if you have a donut and you take a ribbon-like region that wraps around the donut, then by acting on this region with a quantum circuit, you could change the topological charge. But if you're on a donut and you're acting on a small disk, anything that you do inside this disk, by definition, will not change topological charge. Okay? So it's really by conservation. If you're thinking, say, of the toric code, well, the charges would be the vacuum, electric, magnetic, or the fermion, but something like two electric charge can locally be transformed to no electric charge. So they would have the charge of the vacuum. Okay. So really, topological charge are defined by equivalence classes between excitations. Well, once you've identified these excitations, these charges, you find that they can split. So you can have one charge which splits into two charges. And this includes, for instance, the vacuum splitting into two charges. Okay, we'll label them by AA bar, meaning that A bar is the sort of antiparticle of A. Of course, they can also just move around. So you can have a charge here that you move to some other location. And finally, they can fuse. So it's possible to bring two charges together. This stopped working. That gives me a great excuse to use the hockey stick. You bring two charges together, you measure the new charge, and you get some outcome C. And this includes like A and A bar coming together and disappearing. And the neat thing about these things is that I said that the ground state is degenerate, and you can act inside this ground space. You can apply unitary transformation inside this ground space manifold by topological operation, and in particular by braiding. Okay, so if you start braiding excitations around, you will change the state. So this way, you can realize quantum computation. And the entire motivation for topological quantum computation is that these transformation that you realize by topological transformation are robust by nature, because let's say you have two excitations and you braid them. that will induce a transformation on the ground space. Now, these excitations interact with each other at a very, you know, at a short range. So in addition to the topological transformation that you obtain by braiding, you may get some ordinary Schrodinger type evolution just because these guys interact with each other. Okay? But if you make the braid bigger, this Schrodinger type evolution goes away. Okay, and you're left purely with something topological. And the idea is that when you braid two particles, you either braid them or you don't. There's no place for a wiggle room, right? So once the topological operations you get are discrete and they're exact, save from this small additional Schrodinger type evolution that you get. But you can get rid of this by making the system larger, okay? Keeping the particles further apart. So it's sort of a built-in fault tolerance. The larger the system, the less errors you get. And some anyon models support universal quantum computation. So this is sort of the motivation for studying these systems. However, all of this motivation was at zero temperature, okay? Now, what kind of processes can occur at finite temperature? Well, I said that there's a spectral gap. So if you want to create excitation, you need to inject some energy. But of course, if you're in contact with a heat bath, this will happen naturally, and you expect to have a density of defects that is given by simply the Boltzmann weight, right? Delta is the energy required to create an excitation, and T is the temperature. So you expect, at any non-zero temperature, you expect a finite density of thermal defects. Now, the problem is that once you've thermally activated some defects, these guys can fuse and can braid with your computational anion, okay? And that will corrupt the information. So you need to somehow monitor these thermal defects, and this is what this talk is about. Notice that as opposed to the zero temperature case, where there was a scalable way of getting rid of non-topological evolution just by making the system bigger, here it goes the other way around. The bigger the system, the more likely it is that you will suffer from thermal errors, right? Because, like, you know, if I increase the size of my braid, as I'm braiding, it's more likely that I run into one of these thermal defects. Yeah. So it goes the wrong way around. Okay. So this is the problem that we want to address in this talk. Is it possible to do topological quantum computation in a reliable way at non-zero temperature? So I will study a sort of a discrete noise model, and here's the noise model that I will consider. So I will suppose that there's a rate at which pair are created, okay? So with probability QA, a pair AA bar is created at neighboring lattice site, okay, at every time step. Now, these guys have to jointly have a trivial charge jointly, because that's just charge conservation, okay? But individually, they can have charge. Now, if I sum over all non-trivial excitation, this gives me a pair creation rate, Q. Okay, and this will be kind of one of the noise rate in my model. Now, okay, so if I have, this is happening on a discrete lattice, so if I have a pair creation here and a pair creation here, it can happen once in a while that at some time one site holds two topological charges, okay? So in my noise model, I will assume that at every time step, there's a measurement of the charge at every site, okay? So this is as if the environment was sort of monitoring the charge at every site. So this is decoherence in the charge basis, okay? So that's one type of error. The other type of error that I will consider is measurement errors. That is when, I will have to monitor the presence of these thermal defects, because my goal is to eliminate them. But when I perform a measurement, it will report the correct charge with probability 1 minus p, But otherwise, it will just report a random charge A with some probability PA. Okay? So my measurement is not reliable. And of course, the measurement error rate is just the sum of these PA. Now, I could have independently modeled charge displacement, but I haven't done that because moving a charge can be achieved by just creating, you know, if I have a charge sitting here, a charge A, and I create a pair AA bar right next to it, this will have the effect of moving my charge A, or it can have that effect. So I won't model it explicitly. Yes?
So for the pair creation, the last step of the pair creation where you're projecting onto the chart, is there some rule for determining the order if you're at which you're creating these pairs?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. It's a random order, and it's different at every time step.
So when you pick like each
edge.
Each edge.
Yeah.
Randomly.
Yeah.
And a chart that's already there kind of first, and then.
Yeah.
Because the pre-existing state has some
chart. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's the noise model we will consider. Okay, so what's the background on this? So people have studied this kind of problem before. people have studied quantum error correction for non-abelian anions before. So, what I mean by quantum error correction is that you have one round of pair creation, and then you do error correction with perfect measurement. Okay, this is the setting that people have studied before. So I want to contrast this with the case where you have faulty measurement and you're going to correct for multiple rounds. I'll call that the fault tolerance setting. But this is just quantum error correction. This was sort of an important first step. So of course, the main challenge here is decoding. So, you know, there are pair creations. So you have a bunch of excitations. And what you get to see is where are these pairs now? You don't get to see where they came from. So you need to sort of statistically infer the most likely history of these particles. Where did they come from? And you need to pair them up. It's okay if you make a mistake as long as you don't make a mistake that's topologically non-trivial. Okay. So just maybe to draw a picture, you know, if you're on a donut and there's a pair of defects like this, and the reality is that they were sort of created this way, and you think they were created this way, it's fine. But if you think they were created this way, then it's wrong. I mean, then you're the difference between the thing that really happened and what you think happened adds up to something topologically non-trivial. Okay? So that's what you need to do. You need to infer the most likely particle world line homology. You don't need to get exactly the right trajectory. Okay? So that's called the decoding problem, and people have devised decoding algorithms, and they use them in simulations, and they observe thresholds for a bunch of non-abelian anion model, including Ising model. This is work that we've done previously with Courtney and Steve Lamia and Steve Burton and Guillaume, who's the PhD student involved in the current project. Basel group studied phi lambda models, and the Sydney group studied also the Fibonacci anion model. And what I mean when I say that thresholds were observed is that it was observed that below a critical noise rate, the probability of inferring the right world line homology increases with the system size. So in picture, this is the sort of thing that you see. So here you increase, let's say, the pair creation rate, and this is the probability that you infer the wrong homology. And you see this is for different sizes. This is a relatively small system. I think it's 8 by 8, and you increase all the way to 1,000 by 1,000, and you see that provided that the pair creation rate is below about 8% in this case, the bigger the system, the more likely it is that you correctly identify the world line homology. So that we would call the threshold. So thresholds were observed for all of these models. But this was just error correction. We had to assume that the measurements were perfect. So how about when the measurements are not perfect? So fault tolerant, you can define as, you know, fault tolerance is a way of performing error correction with noisy instruments. And in particular here, the noisy instrument will be the measurement. So this has been studied to a great extent for abelian anions. So what's the particularity of abelian anions? The defining property is that the fusion rules are deterministic, okay? That's the greatest distinction between abelian and non-abelian anion. So it might seem like a small difference, but it's actually a big deal. So this means whenever I take two charges together, the total charge is well-defined. Okay, it's uniquely defined, as opposed to for non-abelian anion, when I take two of them together, the total charge is not necessarily uniquely defined. And the way to think about this, like a good analogy to have in mind, is when you take two spin 1/2 together, you can have a spin 0 or a spin 1, right? So spin is sort of an analogy of topological charge. And a consequence of this is that for abelian anion, the Braid group is abelian, hence the name. Okay, so you cannot perform universal quantum computation with abelian anion. So the most studied example of an abelian anion model is the surface code, the toric code. And of course, this is kind of the leading architecture to build a quantum computer, or according to some people. And we know it has a threshold. So in that case, like study whether you're you have a physical system that has excitations, you know, these Z2 excitations like in the toric code, or whether you're thinking of a circuit implementing the surface code on, you know, garden variety qubits, the question you're studying is the same, okay? And we found, it's been found that the system has a threshold around 1%. Yes?
Are you only considering measurement errors and not gate errors?
Well, okay, I mean, in this setting, it would be more like a phenomenological noise model, right? So up to sort of details of the noise, whether it's a circuit model or just some physical system that supports this topological order, I mean, it's really the same question. Modulo some kind of mapping of the noise model. But sort of, we can be confident that a threshold exists. And of course, it may change if you fine-tune the noise model, but it should remain finite. Another particularity is that, so of course, when your measurements are faulty, you should not just perform a measurement of these excitations and then pair up the excitations, because maybe you're missing some excitations, and maybe some places where you think there are excitations, there are actually no excitations. So the way that decoding is done is that you actually accumulate a history of syndrome or a history of charge configuration, and then you decode a space-time block. So decoding is not done like at every time. You accumulate data for a long time, and then you decode like a cube of space-time. Okay, so I'm mentioning these because these will sort of break down when you start dealing with non-abelian anions. Okay, now I have to introduce an ingredient that we built upon, which is fault tolerant using local cellular automata. So a cellular automaton, you should think of a grid of bits or higher dimensional system. And at every time step, the state of a local cell is updated based on the state of the neighbors. This is a purely classical system, right? So you have a square grid. Every site has a d-dimensional system. And there's a rule that says, okay, you should change from state X to state Y depending on your current state and the neighboring state, okay? So it's purely local rule that you just apply sequentially. And well, we know a lot of things about those. This is a popular topic in computer science. For instance, we know that you can perform universal classical computation using cellular automata and so on. And one of the an interesting question is, can a one-dimensional cellular automaton, well, we know that one-dimensional cellular automaton are universal for computation, but can a one-dimensional cellular automaton perform reliable computation in the presence of errors? Okay. That was a big open question, and there was a conjecture called the positive rate conjecture, which asserted it's not possible. From a physics point of view, this sort of the natural answer, right? Because although it's not a Hamiltonian and it's not exactly a statistical mechanics problem, because it's really dynamical, it's like we know that there cannot be a transition phase to an ordered state in a one-dimensional nearest neighbor translationally invariant system, right? So this is sort of an argument that shows, well, so these cellular automaton probably cannot have a phase transition. But more intuitively, the idea is the following. Like, suppose that, you know, you have this cellular automaton, 1D, and at some point, there's an error at some location. With the local update rule, this error will spread, okay? So you start with a small error, and it creates an error bubble. Within this bubble, everything looks fine. Okay, it looks like you're doing a computation, but which is different from the one you should be doing, but inside the bubble, there's no way to tell that. It's only at the boundary of the bubble that you can see that, you know, there's something wrong because the left and the right-hand side of the boundary don't agree with each other. The problem is that if you're sitting at the boundary and you see, all right, here, you know, it's a domain wall between a region that has an error and a region that doesn't have an error, but there's no way for you to tell which side has the error, okay? So there's no way to correct in 1D. That's essentially the intuition. Despite this intuition, Peter Gax found a counterexample, okay? His counterexample is extremely intricate and sophisticated. I never read the full proof. I read only the summary of the proof, which is 72 pages, okay? There is something called a reader's guide to Gax positive rate conjecture. And I mean, it's built over many years, but here's the very rough idea. A reader's guide to the reader's guide's abstract. all right, so what you do is you set up a one-dimensional cellular automaton that corrects only very small errors. Let's say like localized one-bit error. Okay, that can be done. The other thing is that you program this cellular automaton to simulate itself. Okay, so the computation that the cellular automaton is running is a simulation of a one-dimensional cellular automaton. In fact, exactly the same cellular automaton. Okay, so if you look at a collection of Q cells, which we will call a colony, that colony acts as a single cell of the original cellular automaton. Everyone gets that? Using percolation theory, this is a standard argument, you can show that error organized in a hierarchical manner. And I will show this in a bit more detail on the next slide. But the idea is the following. If the base cellular automaton can correct small errors, and if groups of Q cell act like a single cell, it means that the simulation can correct errors acting on groups of qubits. Okay? Sorry?
Not to be confused with qubits.
And they're not even bits. I should say on groups of Q cells, right? Because a group of Q cells acts as a single cell. And moreover, if you look at groups of Q colonies, they look like a single colony. Because the algorithm is simulating itself, and if that's true, it's true at every level. It's a recursive definition, okay? Therefore, it can correct errors on super colonies, which are group of Q square cells, and so on, okay? But of course, the simulation runs slower than the base cellular automaton, So you can say at every u time steps, you've implemented a time step of the cellular automaton. So it means that these errors acting on entire colonies must happen less frequently than errors happening on a single cell. But that's just percolation theory that says, yeah, that's true. Okay, if the errors are just distributed according to some IID, sufficiently low IID model. So the level k errors will be corrected by the level k update rules. Okay. So that's the idea of GAC. All right, so Jim Harrington, in his PhD thesis, borrowed these ideas and essentially noticed that errors in the 2D toric code manifest themselves much like classical errors in a 1D system, meaning that, as you know, if you have a string of errors, you only get to see the endpoint, okay? It's very similar to a classical 1D model where if you have a domain of errors, you only see the endpoint of the domain, okay? So he built on GAC's idea to construct a cellular automaton decoder for the toric code. So there's a hierarchical error organization, which is sort of identical to the one GAC's used. And Bravi has been using this also in many analysis. And the simulation is such that in the cellular automaton, you have group of Q square cells that will form colonies, and you apply local update rule at different levels. Okay. So, I mean, he does not attempt, or neither do we attempt to sort of show how you can actually program the cells so that they self-simulate at different level, but that's just like, you know, it's been done before, so we won't go into that level of detail. Harrington proves the threshold 10 to the minus 11 for the surface code using the cellular automaton decoder, but he does numerics and finds that it's quite competitive, 10 to the minus 3. Okay? So purely local update rules that can perform realize a fault-tolerant quantum error. Okay, so just a bit more detail. I've been mentioning this hierarchical error classification. So how is it defined?
I have a question about the threshold in the previous slide. What error model would that use? How does that basically compare to, let's say, the minimum rate matching?
It's pretty much the same error model. So in fact, it's the one I mentioned. So you have pair creation at some rate, okay, P. And you have also, whenever you perform a measurement, it reports the wrong answer with probability P.
It's
phenomenological, yes. Correct. Okay, so let's say that these are errors. Okay, and there are some root parameters, Q and A, and I will set Q equal to 5, A equal to 1. So this is the collection of all the errors on the lattice. So you have level 0 candidate errors. These are errors that fit in a 2x2 box. Okay, so here are all the candidate level 0 error. These guys fit in a 2x2 box. These guys fit 2x2 and so on. But the level 0 actual errors are the one that they're the candidate level 0 error that are separated by distance A from the rest. So, the black, everything is a candidate level 0 error, but only the ones that are sufficiently separated from the rest are actual level 0 error, okay? So you see, this guy here fits in a 2x2 box and is at a distance 2 from any other error. Same here, same here, same here. It wouldn't be true, say, of these two. They fit in a 2x2 box, but they're sitting right next to another error. So they're not level 0 actual error. So once you've identified these level 0 actual errors, you remove them, and then you say, all right, this is my noise model with level 0 noise removed. The level 1 candidate errors will be all the errors that fit in a 6x6 box. So this fits in a 6x6 box, this fits, this guy fits, this guy fits. These jointly do not fit. Okay, so this is a candidate, this is a candidate, this is a candidate, this is a candidate. In addition, they have to be at a distance a time q from the rest. So in this case, it's 6. So this is an actual level 1 error. This is an actual level 1 error. Neither of these are, because they're too close to each other. So you just go on, and now these are actual level 2 error. Okay? So this is how you define, and it's quite easy to prove that the error rate at level n is less than this quantity here. Okay? Given p is the base error rate, q is just this parameter here. So this is how the rate of level n error drop. Okay. Now we will be considering a 2+1 dimensional setting where you don't just have errors in space, but also in time. So p is the spatial error rate, q is the temporal error rate, and q is sort of the renormalization factor in space, and u is the renormalization factor in time. If you want, u is the number of time step it takes for the base cellular automaton to simulate one iteration of itself. Okay, so you see that provided that the sum of p and q is less than 1/(this quantity), this error drops doubly exponentially with the level of the error. Okay? So that will set our threshold. Okay, so the rules are very roughly as follows. So the lattice is divided into colonies of size q by q. So before you declare that there is a syndrome at some location, you need to see it. It needs to persist for some predetermined amount of time. So if you see a charge, you don't say, oh, there's a charge here. You just wait. You keep on seeing it, then you'll say, all right, there's a charge here. Now, if you become convinced that there is a charge and that you also become convinced that there's a charge right next to it, well, you bring them together. Okay. But if you become convinced that at some location there is a charge, but you don't see any immediate neighbor, you just move that charge towards the colony center. The idea is that, you know, probably everything was created in the same colony, so if you bring everything to the middle, well, it will correct. Of course, the problem with this is that what if there's something that was created at the border of a colony? Well, in the next level of the hierarchy, these will be right next to each other. So you will correct them right away. So after u time step, you will create. And at every u time step, you consider clusters of q by q colonies, and you organize them into supercolony, and you apply the transition rule at the level of supercolonies. So you look at the center of supercolonies. All the charge should have been brought to the center by then. You look at the charge. If the center is charged and this center is charged, you bring them together. If not, you bring it to the center of the supercolony, and so on and so forth. Okay. And Harrington's main result is, provided that the consensus A, B, Q, and U are chosen carefully, level K actual errors are corrected by level K transition rule. Okay? So the idea is you organize your errors into different levels, and you show that level by level, the errors are corrected by the level, you know, the corresponding level. Okay. So our idea was to apply these methods to non-abelian anions. And I won't have time to tell you all the details about the implementation. What I want to highlight, the only thing I want to highlight, is what kind of problems we encounter when we try to apply these methods to non-abelian anion. And I want to consider two types of problems. Some are like intrinsic to the problem of doing fault-tolerant quantum computation with non-abelian anions. And some are more related to the algorithm or the proof technique. Okay. So let's start with the intrinsic problem. Remember that I said that these analysis, first problem is that this 2+1 dimensional picture breaks down. Okay, you can't accumulate these charge measurements and then at the end decide, here's what I'm going to do. Okay, why is that? Because you don't know the outcome of the fusion process until you actually do it. Okay, so here's a physical picture. This is borrowed like from the Ising anion model, if that rings a bell. So These are Ising anions. They were created from the vacuum. So this is a pair. This is another pair that was created from the vacuum. Now, you know, in this 3+1 dimensional picture, you wouldn't touch them. And at the end, you would say, what I should have done back in time is bring them together. Okay? I haven't done it, but I know that this is what I should have done, and I can just keep track of that change. It's like a basis change. However, for non-abelian anions, let's say maybe you think that you should bring those together. If you do so, they may fuse to the vacuum, but they may fuse to something that is not the vacuum. Remember, they're non-abelian anions. Okay? So the fusion outcome is not deterministic. So you need a second step. Okay? In this case, you would need to bring these two fermions together to get the vacuum. So you see that error correction must be a dynamical process. Okay?
You have to actually implement the error correction live in time. Moreover, this is something that is unique to non-abelian anions. Fusion makes error correction an irreversible process. So let's go back to this example. So if you consider this example again, okay? Like, if you choose to bring these guys together and they fuse to a fermion, you know you didn't make the right call, okay? Because they should have fused to the vacuum, and the fact that they gave you the fermion tells you you made a wrong decision, which is sort of nice. It's extra information that you're getting. However, on the downside, you can't go back because you collapsed the wave function. Okay? There's no analogy for abelian anions. Okay? Everything that you do in error correction is reversible. But for non-abelian anion, it's not. So this is, in some sense, it's a feature because you get extra information. You know you did something wrong, and you get a second chance. But you can't go back to where you started from. So we had to introduce a new idea, which we call the trajectory domain of an error, to deal with this sort of problem. And it's essentially the set of sites whose amplitude of supporting a certain topological charge at a time t is changed by the presence of an error. So essentially, if you have an error, it will create charges. And these charges may have different history because the fusion rule is not deterministic. And we're looking at all the possible histories, and we call this the error domain, the trajectory domain, sorry, of an error. Okay, so you have an error, it will create anions, and these anions will have certain trajectories. But these trajectories can depend on the fusion outcome, which are probabilistic. So we're looking at the union of all these trajectories. And these are the sort of objects that we need to analyze in our proof. The other type of intrinsic problem that we get is that you can have two small errors, like in this case. Let's say this is a small error. It was a creation of a pair of particles. This is another small error. And if these guys fuse now, you've sort of glued two small errors into a bigger error, meaning that now you have to correct these two excitations. This happens for non-abelian anions. It also happens for abelian anions. So this is not new. However, this is a new sewing mechanism for non-abelian anions, because, here's a small error. Here's another small error. Now you've braided them. So there's nothing you can do that involves only like this region of space that will correct this error. You need a correction that will act on this region of space because they braided together. Okay? So we have sort of a new mechanism for taking two small errors and making a big error out of it. For this to happen, the particles need to meet head on. For this, they only need to braid. So this sort of thing happens much more often than this sort of thing. There's an extra dimension, if you want. So you can expect, there are many more ways to braid than there are to fuse. So you may expect that you get like an additional entropic contribution from this, just from counting, and that this sort of entropy would favor this ordered phase. That's typically what happens. okay, now let me address problems with the proof technique. Or maybe not the proof technique, but with the specific decoding algorithm that we're using. So let's say that this is an error distribution, and I will color them according to their level. So the green guys are level zero error, they're well isolated and they fit in a small box, and the blue guy are higher level errors. So, okay, these guys are fine, I'll correct them, so let me ignore them. Let me just focus here. These are the errors, now let me draw the topological charges that are created from these errors. These are the circles. Okay? So let me erase the errors and just focus on the charges that were created by these errors. So, I mean, according to my error classification, you know, or according to Harrington's result, the level, you know, this error should be corrected by level zero cellular automaton, and this one maybe by level two cellular automaton. Let's say that, you know, my level two cellular automaton rightfully identified these two guys as being a pair. It says, all right, you know, fuse them together. You do so, but in doing so, you've braided with this pair. So yes, the errors were far apart, but the correction procedure may have brought the excitations close together. So it shows that the error classification is not appropriate for this. So in this particular example, because you braided with this one, when you fuse here, you may or may not get the vacuum. And in that case, you would need to consider a correction of something that was a level zero error jointly with a level k error. This never happens in Harrington or for abelian error. Okay, so the idea that level k errors are handled by level k transition rules break down. This is sort of a big deal. So for this, we introduce an idea of causally linked cluster, which is, well, this is an idea of errors. Sorry, this is an example of errors that are causally linked, okay? Because they sort of braided with each other. So it's the set of errors that have directly or indirectly interacted with an error, e prior to time. And this is the type of object. We will need to analyze the sort of the size of these causally linked clusters. Another problem is that, well, just defining whether the algorithm has succeeded or not is sort of a tricky thing. So you would like, remember, that there will be the idea of what's the charge of a colony. Well, what's the charge of a colony? Naively, you could say, well, it's just the sum of the charges that are contained in the colony. Okay. Well, obviously, that's sort of a bad definition because it will fluctuate like crazy because of pairs that are created along its boundary. So you might want to refine that definition and say, all right, it's the sum of the errors, the charges in the colony, but only the charges that are associated to high-level errors, not the small guys. Okay, this seems like a reasonable definition, and it's the one adopted by Harrington. Okay, so in that case, I would sort of ignore these green guys and say, I'm considering the charge of the colony is the charge of these blue guys. The green guys are just small fluctuations that will be handled by low-level transition rules. What's the sum of these guys? Well, to know the sum, I sort of need to physically bring them together, okay? Because you know it's not abelian, so I can't just add numbers. Well, I said all of this. Do I bring them together this way or this way? Depending on how I want to bring them together, they have a different topological charge. Okay? It's actually a path dependent. So you see that it's sort of, how do you even define what is the charge of a colony? It's hard to define. So we have to define what's a valid level K syndrome. It's the total charge of the level K anions, and the level K anions are the anions belonging to a level K causally linked cluster. Now you may say, well, how does it handle this? Well, in that case, these guys would precisely become linked with the error. Okay, so the fact that they sort of influence the charge means that they are causally linked and they belong to the thing that you're trying to do. That was, I hope you understand this detail, but there are a lot of technical details. The final obstacle was a bit more serious. And I'm saying this because we didn't find a way to handle it. We had to sort of restrict the generality of a result. So it's again the same thing, that error correction of high-level errors, so imagine that these are far apart, they were created by a high-level error, and you know your decoding algorithm knows that they should go together, so if you bring them together, they will fuse to the vacuum and you'll be happy. So all right, you start bringing them together. While you're doing so, there's a small error that occurs along the path. So when you bring them together, in the absence of this fluctuation, they would have fused to the vacuum, but they won't. They fuse to something else, B. Okay, and then maybe you bring these guys together, and just by charge conservation, you see that it must fuse to B bar, because the thing has to be neutral. All right, so now you say, well, I get a second shot. I'm going to bring these guys together. While I do so, there might be another fluctuation. Okay. And so on and so forth. So I have AA bar goes to B because of fluctuation, then I have BB bar goes to C, and so on. And this I can use if there is a fusion that allows me to do this, I will define a graph based on this. Okay? So I will have a directed graph with AA bar, so the vertices are labeled by particle and antiparticle. And there will be an edge between A and B vertex if there exists a fusion channel that goes from AA bar to B, or B bar. Okay? Now, if this graph is acyclic, I will call this an acyclic anion model. And otherwise, I will call it cyclic. Okay? So if you're John Yard, you're wondering, did these things exist? And they do. Okay. So here are some examples. So this is a Fibonacci anion. It has the vacuum in the Fibonacci anion. And the Fibonacci anion, when you bring two of those together, it can give you the vacuum or itself. So clearly, it's cyclic. Here's the Ising anion model. So sigma sigma bar can give you either the vacuum or the fermion. Two fermions that give you the vacuum. It's acyclic. Okay. These are more exotic models. So this is SO2 level 5. It's cyclic. And here's like the first non-trivial interesting model that we find. It's the quantum double of the Quaternion group, and it's acyclic. Okay. So you probably don't see the little arrows. No, here are arrows. It's acyclic. You can check. So you understand that we need this thing. Otherwise, this correction, these high-level correction, they just keep on failing and failing. And in fact, it's very likely that they will, because it's very likely that as you drag this, there will be a small fluctuation, because remember, these guys are very far apart. They're high-level errors. So we had to impose this acyclic problem. So if A is a non-cyclic anion model, then there exists a critical value, PC, such that if the pair creation rate and the measurement error rate is less than this critical probability, for any number of prime step t, any epsilon greater than 0, there exists a linear system size that scales logarithmically with the logical failure rate, such that the probability of at least one epsilon, the encoded quantum state can in principle be recovered after t times n. I mean, it's the standard formulation. Essentially what it's saying is that provided that you're below threshold, you can do quantum computation for some arbitrary amount of time. All that you need is a lattice size that grows linearly with the time, and the probability of error will drop exponentially with the lattice. Okay? So this is the theorem. Now, what are these? There were some, this PC, this says that it exists. Now, we estimated it. We just found lower bound on it. By choosing these Q, U, A, B parameters, right? And this is the lower bound that we get. So it's 10 to the minus 20 times D, and D is the diameter of the acyclic graph. Okay. So if you want to get an idea, the smallest D would be for the Ising anion, where it's 2, and we get a threshold of 10 to the minus 20, which isn't great, so we also did numerics. Now, the numerics are a bit tricky. Why? Because you're simulating a non-abelian anion gas. And non-abelian anions are universal for quantum computation. So even though the cellular automaton can be efficiently implemented. That's not the problem. So the error correction procedure itself is, you know, efficient. However, verifying that your error correction procedure worked in a simulation is BQP complete. Okay. But you just have to compute rate. So yeah, that's what I'm saying. Quantum error correction can be simulated, but verifying the success is hard. So for this, we use the Ising anion because they generate Clifford operations, and these guys can be efficient and simulated. So here's what we will do. I mean, we will simulate this process, this anion gas for a certain amount of time, and the anion gas will evolve under the cellular automaton update rules. And after some long time t, we will ask the question, has the information been lost, or is it in principle retrievable? Now, we cannot answer the question whether it's in principle retrievable, so we will instead ask, is it in practice retrievable? And to answer this question, we will use the method that we had previously developed, you know, for perfect measurement. So what I'm saying is that you run the simulation for some time t, and then you pretend that at this time you have perfect measurement, and you error correct, and you check if you get the right answer. Okay. And this is the error rate, and this is the average memory time for a different system size. Okay. And what you see, we don't have a very clear crossing here, but I would say that the results are in agreement with a threshold that's somewhere between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 3. Much better than 10 to the minus 20. So if you're interested in the particular value of Q and U that we use, here they are. And yeah, it's the threshold, just by eyeballing it, looks like it's around 10 to the minus 20. Okay. All right, so that was it. So in summary, topological quantum computation requires error correction at finite temperature. So it's not, I mean, there's, you know, it's sort of folklore that these systems are intrinsically fault-tolerant, but that's only true at zero temperature. As soon as you turn on a temperature, you need to correct for errors. Non-abelian anions pose many additional challenges, and it's the non-abelian anions that are interesting from a topological quantum computation point of view, because they're the only one that can be universal. So what we have done here is we've adapted a cellular automaton fault-tolerant scheme to non-cyclic anion models. And the threshold we find is 10 to the minus 23 in theory, or that's the theory lower bound, and 10 to the minus 4 numerics. So there's, of course, this limitation of that the models have to be cyclic, acyclic. I personally believe that this is just a technical problem with our proofing, and that this can probably be dealt with. But I won't go into the motivation of why I think this is true. I mean, there is probably a lot of room for improvement in our simulation and in our algorithm in general. And the most obvious one is that our current algorithm does not even look at the topological charges. Okay? It only says, is there a charge here? Is there a charge? Yes, here. If the answer is yes, I bring them together. Even, for instance, if these guys can't even in principle fuse to the vacuum, I would nonetheless bring it together. Okay. So this seems like an overkill. It seems like you could do something much better by informing the algorithm about the fusion rules and taking that into account when you move charges. That's the first thing that we do. All right, so that's it. And a little bit of advertisement. We're just starting a new center. It's called the Institut Quantique in Sherbrooke. We got lots of money recently, and we're looking for talented grad student postdocs, visiting faculty scientists. And then you just email me or come and visit if you are interested. We have some visitor in the room. It's an awesome place. No.
I haven't been.
Okay, so that was the advertisement. Thank you for your attention. Questions for David? Yes.
Just to so I could get something clear, when you bring together two fast separated anions, you're effectively doing this in one time step because you're not doing the self-simulation, right?
Yes. So, well, it depends on what you mean. We only do so, let's say that they're level one anions. We only do so at every U time step.
But the transport time is...
But the transport time in the simulation, we did it in one step.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking that, I mean, it seems that if you were to actually make these things step along at unit time, I mean, effectively making the error correction problem harder.
Harder?
Well, yeah, I mean, then you need to, I mean, this is an extra difficulty you need to worry about, but then the proof techniques for acyclic stuff might work better because it's not, I mean, directly going, zipping straight through a small pair.
I don't think that it would make any difference.
Really?
I thought, yeah, because look, the point is this. What's important is that when you bring them, okay, mm-hmm. there's a predetermined path. When you bring them along this path, you know, you will go through a gas of anion. This gas of anion is sort of in a steady state, right? Because,
sure.
I mean, you know, this is a long time behavior. So whether you go in one shot or you go slowly, you will see the same thing.
I mean, if I'm going slowly, then as I pass through two closely separated anions, this is, I mean, those three things will all get fused together at a lower level.
No, because the partner is still over there. Yeah, they might get fused, but I mean...
Well, then I'm dragging the extra faulty charge along the path, right?
Ah, no. Uh-huh. No. Because the instruction is you're dragging an A charge.
Right.
Okay, I did not mention this. Okay, there is a subtlety. Like, what if you're dragging an A charge, but it's actually physically a B charge?
Mm-hmm.
The way we model this is we say you're actually creating an AA bar from site to site. That's how we model it.
Right.
It's the same question that would arise with ghost charges.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to model this, and we sort of push it onto pair creation errors.
Okay.
But so I mean, this is something I've thought about,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think it would change anything, just because you're in a station.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank David again.